Good morning. It's 8:06. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Parker Malatesta, filling in for Leslie Thatcher on this Tuesday, August 5th. It is 52 degrees here in Old Town Park City, a little bit warmer, around 59 in the Heber Valley. We're looking at sunny conditions today, high of 86 in Park City, high of 90 in Heber. Lows tonight in the 50s and a chance for some patchy smoke rolling in later in the day today going into tonight. And then should stay sunny looking ahead this week into the weekend. Highs in the 80s in Park City expected throughout the week, and then could breach the 90s in Heber Wednesday and Thursday before cooling down on Friday. We will not have a weather report from meteorologist Cedric Haynes today. But moving to traffic, not seeing any crashes to report across the Wasatch Back this morning. However, am seeing a few slowdowns and congestion and kind of the normal areas you would expect. Eastbound I-80 between Kimball Junction and US 40, just seeing a bit of slowdown there. And then also on State Route 248 heading into Park City proper, little bit of backup there around the PC Hill area. Well, coming up, Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh will share what to expect at this week's county council meeting, and he'll have more on the investigation into the county sheriff's department. Then Utah Outliers game operations manager Bill McLeod introduces Park City's newest hockey team and how locals can get involved. We'll end the hour with Summit Lands Conservancy CEO Cheryl Fox. She'll discuss the latest open space developments and the upcoming Blue Sky Bash. Getting into some local news, Prospector area residents are invited to hear updates, ask questions, and provide input on the future of State Route 248 at a neighborhood event later today. Park City Municipal is hosting an open house at Prospector Park today from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. to talk about its ongoing study for the future of State Route 248, Bonanza Drive, and Deer Valley Drive. City officials are considering several alternatives, including dedicated bus lanes, light rail, and automated guideway transit, similar to a monorail. The city is also exploring a transit alignment along the rail trail. State Route 248 is one of the two major roads in and out of Park City managed by the Utah Department of Transportation. On an average winter day in 2023, nearly 20,000 vehicles drove on State Route 248, according to a city staff report. That marks an 11% increase in traffic since 2015. A conditions report published last year shows trips that include State Route 248 are projected to increase by 43% in 2050 due to anticipated growth in Summit and Wasatch counties. Delays on the state roadway can be particularly acute during ski season, primarily in December, January, and February, when travel between Quinns Junction and Old Town can stretch to over 30 minutes. At Prospector Park later today, residents can learn about the proposed transit improvements and meet Park City Council members and city staff working on the study. The city said it is a casual drop-in style event with no formal presentation. Parkites unable to attend can learn more about the project online and provide feedback over email. A link can be found at kpcw.org. The Park City Council is scheduled to discuss the State Route 248 study at its meeting August 14th. And as a note, Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. A reminder again that open house is happening at Prospector Park from 5:30 to 6:30 today. Well, a Park City couple was on the turbulent Delta Airlines flight that sent 25 people to the hospital last week. KPCW's Christine Weller has more on their experience.
Parkites Charlotte and Matthew Turner were on Delta Flight 56 from Salt Lake City to Amsterdam when it hit serious turbulence over the Rocky Mountains in Wyoming Wednesday. Charlotte Turner said it was about an hour into the flight, and flight attendants were just starting to hand out snacks and drinks to the 275 passengers on the Airbus.
We hit some turbulence, and the first one was like, okay, that was big. That was pretty big. And then the second one was bigger. And then all I remember was we were just dropping in the air, and I hear people screaming. I see carts flying in the air, people flying in the air, and stuff everywhere. And
In a phone call from Norway Friday, Turner said she and her husband are frequent flyers, but had never experienced turbulence like this. She said the plane was surrounded by clouds, which added to the fear and uncertainty on board. But the scariest part was the sound of the wind whooshing against the plane.
We could feel it lifting the plane back up. Felt like we had no control. And, oh God, it literally was like a low vibration whoosh against the walls. It like rattled things and you could feel it.
Turner thought that turbulence would end after the first few bumps, but it continued for about 5 minutes. During the final turbulent drop, passengers not wearing seatbelts and flight attendants serving drinks were thrown around the cabin.
That last one was probably the scariest moment I've ever experienced on a plane because we dropped, I think it was about 400 meters.
That's about 1,300 feet. Turner said a man nearby who wasn't wearing a seatbelt flew up and left a crack on the ceiling with his head, and a couple a few rows ahead got whiplash. There are also reports a flight attendant broke a rib. Once things calmed down, passengers went silent, but Turner said some unbuckled their seatbelts to grab phones that had been thrown around the cabin. Flight attendants yelled at them to stay in their seats. When the plane was finally diverted and landed in Minneapolis, Turner said passengers cheered. In total, 25 people were injured, including 7 crew members. Turner's advice after the harrowing flight, always wear your seatbelt.
The chaos was because people weren't buckled and things were able to fly around hurting people.
National Weather Service meteorologist Sam Weber said there are many causes for flight turbulence. The most common are changes in wind speed and direction. Mountain ranges can also disrupt the air. That's a phenomenon called mountain wave development.
That's basically when you get a lot of strong wind rolling over a mountain range and you get kind of a wave to develop on the downwind side of the mountain range. Very commonly, you can get moderate to severe turbulence with those mountain wave developments.
This may have been a factor in the Delta flight, which passed over the Rocky Mountains. Weber said thunderstorms can also cause turbulence as they have their own wind patterns. And a Salt Lake City branch of the National Weather Service's aviation unit warned of thunderstorm potential in Wyoming Wednesday. Charlotte Turner is on KPCW's Community Advisory Board. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Joining me over the phone now, I have Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. Good morning, Dustin.
Good morning, Parker.
Yeah, wanted to start things off before getting into tomorrow's agenda. Is there any update on the 2 investigations into alleged misconduct at the county sheriff's office?
I'm not in the loop on what Cache County's status is, but we've been conducting our own investigation with an outside investigator, and I think I have a sense from Judge McKelvey, who's conducting that investigation, that we're nearing the end of that process. There's a little bit of research that he's doing, and he's in the process, as far as I'm aware, of drafting a report, but we don't have it yet, and we don't have it completed.
Gotcha. And just to recount, one of those is being done, as you mentioned, by a retired judge, and the other one has separately been referred to Cache County for them to investigate?
Yeah, that was my understanding some weeks ago.
All right. Well, moving on to tomorrow, I understand there will be discussion on the Sitla land, which lies east of Heber. I think just to set up this discussion, can you first talk about what Sitla is and kind of the stakeholders in this property?
Yeah, so Sitla is an acronym for a state agency called the State Institutional Trust Land Administration. This is an entity that was basically given previously federal property for the benefit of primarily students in Utah. And so their role is to take advantage of the trust that the funds and the property that they've given to leverage those funds into funding schools. So there is a piece of property just east of Heber City that is part of this Sitla property. It's a pretty big piece of maybe 720 acres. And there is an adjacent property owner that has approached over the last, I think it's been 2 years now, the city, Heber City and Wasatch County, about the possibility of developing that. And so we have been in discussions between the two entities and kind of interlocally as well about what, if any, changes we should make related to these particular properties in question.
Yeah, I mean, what is the vision right now for what these properties could be in the future?
I mean, right now, most of them are zoned in our preservation 160 zone. That's P160, meaning 160-acre lots. And I think the county council has generally shied away from upzoning properties. That said, there's a little bit of a unique wrinkle with CITLA in that CITLA, as a state authority, has some ability of exerting some exemptions to local control. And so that said, the county and I believe Heber City have been considering making some changes to those land use designations, just out of an interest of, I think, trying to have the best possible outcome for everyone involved.
Yeah, and I mean, how much density is kind of anticipated in that area?
So the numbers that we've been talking about, and we've shared this at, you know, some interlocal meetings, and we've had some county council meetings, we have a subcommittee of council members who've been working with the development partners and the state agency on what that would look like. The development group has requested 894 units previously. Excuse me, I'm sneezing. Sorry about that.
You're good.
But we are actually going to see a revised proposal from them. I think the general indication from my council has been that 894 is too much, and we kind of have asked them to come back with as low as they could go as far as density to see what is under consideration.
Yeah, would there be any affordable units, or would it be entirely market rate?
I think it's hard to say. So CITLA doesn't have a mandate for affordable housing, but I believe it is a priority of the state. And so it's possible that affordable housing could be part of the mix, but I don't think it's guaranteed.
Yeah. And so does the county ultimately have the approval rights here? Or as you mentioned, it kind of lies more with CITLA. What's kind of the end game with this?
Yeah. So, I think it's a little bit ambiguous in that previously CITLA has approached the county for some land use changes, and this is some years ago, that the county previously denied. And I think generally they have shared at our meetings and others that they prefer to work with local land use authorities. I believe that they have had at least one instance where somewhere in Utah they have exerted some level of exemption. But the details of that, and there are just a lot of practical limitations with this property, that it's very mountainous, it's a critical watershed, and we're hesitant to see a lot of really increased density in an area like this that's really never been planned for it, for communication and transportation infrastructure and water and sewer and all of those things that present a lot of really big roadblocks for a project like this.
Yeah, and just to loop it all around, what will kind of be the focus for the county council tomorrow in discussing this?
So I think the main thrust is to hear the revised proposal from the development group and to see if it better aligns with the council's priorities, and then kind of to take the next steps to see if it does, then, you know, working with them on what that entitlement might look like. And if not, then maybe some other alternatives of continued negotiations on what that appropriate level of density might be.
Yes. All right. Well, moving on to the Heber Valley Temple, the judge recently ruled in favor of Wasatch County and the LDS Church that has been appealed by residents of Red Ledges, but do you have a response just in general to Judge Mabee's ruling that the approval process was legal?
Yeah, I think it really just validates the work that our staff put into that process. I think we tried to be as thorough as we could be, and we ensured that we followed all state code, and really the judge's ruling kind of vindicates that perspective, and we understand that there are strong opinions about this issue, but ultimately Wasatch County, I think, follow the proper process and Judge Mabee found that that was the case.
Yeah, and can you kind of talk about how the entitlement process works now that, you know, that we have seen a ruling, but, you know, the residents are now moving to appeal that ruling. How does that affect the true approval of the development on the property?
Yeah, so to my knowledge, from the original approval, their entitlement stands, and that there has not been a judge that has stayed or revoked any of those approvals. So the county issued a building permit, actually, I think we're coming up on at least a year and a half of having the building permit issued. I think it's really the property owner that has not executed or used that building permit at their own discretion for whatever reason. And so I think that it's still possible that the property owner could utilize that building permit and proceed. But, you know, they obviously don't include us in their construction timetables or anything like that.
Okay. As you mentioned, Dustin, you know, this has been a contentious issue. I mean, is there anything else you want to just say to residents that may be kind of on both sides of the aisle on this?
Yeah, I think Wasatch County, we had a long and robust process, and not everyone, I think, is aware of all of the things that we tried to do to ensure that we were discussing everything very publicly, that we were working through upgrading our dark sky standards so that they were even better than they were before, and that the temple abides by those standards. And ultimately, I think it aligns with the community's vision, and I think will be an asset to our community.
Yeah, moving on, Midway has been discussing possibly adding curbside recycling. That would be the first place in Wasatch County to offer recycling, from my understanding. Has Wasatch County generally looked at any sort of recycling program like this?
Yeah, there have been discussions in the past, just because, you know, it is a topic that a lot of residents are interested in. Thus far, the county council that acts as the governing board for the Solid Waste Special Service District has not engaged in that, because there are currently for-profit contractors who provide the service in the valley, and Wasatch County Council has thus far kind of not wanted to impact those for-profit businesses.
Yeah, any changes that you think would have to be made to make something like that work?
Yeah, it would be an expansion of our services. I think it's possible that it could be implemented, but really it's just a balance of the political pressures of, if the county council feels like it's sufficient priority, there would need to be funding dedicated to it and rates adopted and all of those things. And so I think it's an option. It's just not one that we have gone down the path of yet.
Yeah. Well, moving on separately, I know the county has been putting in some work to look at e-bike regulations. Is there any kind of update there on what you guys are looking at?
Yeah, I believe Midway City, Heber City, and Wasatch County have all adopted e-bike regulations that are fairly close in the standards that we've used. Generally, what we're trying to do is educate people about the existing state code. State code outlines, you know, specific limitations that I think a lot of people really aren't aware of that kids under 14 need parental supervision when using e-bikes. What constitutes an e-bike and doesn't? You know, if it doesn't have pedals, it's not an e-bike and is basically a motorized vehicle and needs to be treated that way. That said, Wasatch County and the other entities have added beyond the state code, you know, things that what types of vehicles are allowed on trails, limiting speed to kind of safer standards, limiting how much e-bikes use public turf, just because it can be destructive to grass on parks and things like that.
Yeah, and has the county seen any kind of particular increase in use? Because I'm well, you know, here in Park City, there's not there's quite a lot of strict rules around using e-bikes on single track, but I understand over at East Village, there's a lot of usage allowed there for e-mountain bikes. Have you guys seen any kind of uptick in usage in the area?
I think most of the attention and the uptick has been in primarily youth utilization of e-bikes and other electronic vehicles. And so that's where a lot of the attention has been on, is how quickly some of these very young children are riding along the road and how we can educate the public and the youth about what is safe, what is legal, and what's best practices.
Yeah. Well, you know, moving on, I did want to ask about, you know, East Village, the resort base, Deer Valley's new resort base is kind of coming fully online this winter. I mean, is there kind of anything Wasatch County is looking to do to kind of support a more tourism-based economy in that area?
Yeah, I think some of the things that we're considering and have been talking with High Valley Transit for some time is about what transit in the area looks like and when we might be able to launch a more robust transit service connecting both to the Deer Valley East Village and into Park City. I know High Valley Transit has kind of made a proposal for what an all-day service. So right now we have kind of more of a commuter service that has an AM and PM higher frequency. We adopted a transit sales tax last year that affords us some options, but so far the county council has wanted to kind of continue to evaluate some of those options. I know they're also really interested in connections down 189, because as you said, the area is coming online and a lot of these are hotels and commercial spaces that need a lot of employees, and we're expecting a lot of people to have to come, not just from north, you know, in Salt Lake County and elsewhere, but also from the south in Utah County, where we think a lot of these employees will come from. And I think that's all part of the transportation infrastructure. So we're coordinating with UDOT on a Highway 40 study. This is UDOT Region 2 is conducting a study that can, where Highway 40 connects to I-80 all the way down to River Road, which is basically the end of the Heber Valley Corridor project. So they'll be looking at all of the capacity and changes that may need to be made in that, those areas. So I think all of those things have the opportunity to benefit the transportation network around there.
Yeah, and speaking of that, kind of the Utah County crowd, you know, Park City spends a lot of time looking into, you know, sort of these capture park and ride lots. I mean, is that something you all could potentially be interested in as that kind of resort area traffic increases?
Absolutely. We are actively looking for opportunities to identify parks and ride. I think this is one area that we're hoping to find some synergy with the Olympics, just because having more robust transit infrastructure in the valley is going to help as we service the Soldier Hollow. So we're hoping that we can find some alignment between the Utah Olympic Committee's priorities and Wasatch County's general transit priorities so that we can get some synergy there. That includes park and rides and other transit services.
Yeah, and I mean, since you mentioned it, any other, you know, sort of larger initiatives the county is starting to look at with, you know, the Winter Games kind of on the horizon, or, I mean, we're still quite some years away, but, you know, starting to think about other potential improvements?
Yeah, I think we have the advantage of, you know, in a lot of these areas of already having great existing facilities. So contrary to last time, you know, there was the creation of the Soldier Hollow venue. Right now what we're talking about is primarily, I think, transit and transportation infrastructure and the various ways in which those could be impacted. I think also long-term, what we're looking at is what are things that benefit the county on the long-term, because the Olympics is really a time-limited impact. And if we were only doing something for Olympics, I don't know how high of a priority it would reach for us. But like I said before, where there are synergies, where there are things that we need anyways that align with that, and we think that's potentially things like housing and transit and transportation are the two highest priorities there.
Yeah, and just speaking of transportation, lastly, Dustin, with UDOT looking at the kind of US 40 interchange over there and potential changes to take it off Heber Main Street. Does the county kind of have a preferred alternative, or kind of separately, what are you all watching for in that process?
So the county council has issued a few official comments in the past and previous steps in this process, kind of encouraging UDOT to stick with what has been the established alignment under the county when this was kind of a county project. Those were the alignments that stuck closer to Heber City. But overall, our most recent statement to UDOT was a unanimous support of, hey, we need a bypass, not just for the Olympics, but just for ourselves, that we need more robust transportation infrastructure. And so I think the county council would prefer those options that stick closer to Heber City. But overall, I think the priority is to work with UDOT on a solution.
Yeah. Anything else you want to mention, Dustin, or a county fair coming up? Any details you want to share?
Actually, we just wrapped up we had a great fair, and actually we had our Parks and Rec director. This was his grand finale. He actually started our Parks and Rec department 30 years ago.
Wow.
So this is his last fair, and so we were able to honor his years of service, and he'll be retiring effective next week. So,
well, love the dedication. Well, thanks so much for joining me this morning, Dustin, and have a good day.
Thanks, you as well.
Getting into some news, Heber will launch a safety bonus program aimed at reducing accidents among city employees in high-risk risk jobs. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has details on that.
City employees considered at high risk include police officers, public works staff, airport operators, and more. Over 60 people are eligible. Under the new program, City Manager Matt Brower says they will be eligible for a $500 bonus every year if they are accident-free and complete safety training.
And we want to make sure that our employees continue to go home every night to their families and come back to work the next day.
The safety incentive program comes in the wake of a 2022 accident when a trench collapsed and nearly killed a man. Brower says since then, the number of accidents has declined and he wants the city to continue that trend.
This is all about trying to create a culture of safety, and I think we can best do that through pay for performance.
If an accident does happen, a committee will review whether it was preventable. If so, the employee responsible could lose their bonus. The program will cost the city about $31,000 for fiscal year 2026 if all 62 eligible employees follow the safety protocol. It is part of the consent agenda for Tuesday's City Council meeting, meaning council members are unlikely to discuss it in depth. An agenda and a link to attend the meeting online are available at kpcw.org. Heber City is a financial supporter of KPCW. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Now joined in studio by Utah Outliers Game Operations Manager Bill McLeod. How's it going this morning, Bill?
It's doing good, Parker. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're here to talk about, I'm sure if people have been driving on State Route 248 near the Jordan L, they've been seeing the big arena kind of coming up there by Black Rock Resort. What's the status of that right now? I mean, it's almost done, right?
Oh, yeah, it's going well. We're looking to hopefully complete that here in the next month or so, month and a half timeline. We don't have a solid timeline yet, but we're definitely working hard and to try to get that building finished.
And so let's talk about the hockey that's going to be on display there. This is the Outliers organization. From what I understand, they've been in West Valley for sort of the last 9 years at the Accord Ice Center. Tell me about this kind of this part of the league. It's kind of pre-college, potentially professional. Where are kind of these players at?
Yeah, it's a higher level of hockey, one of the highest levels of junior hockey you can play in the country. They're elite athletes from all over the world. They're training their whole lives to become either collegiate athletes or professional athletes. And so our program's designed to help them kind of springboard into those avenues and those ventures. So they've worked really hard, and it's actually great hockey.
Yeah.
We've got a lot of players that play professional now or play D1, D3 college programs, and this particular league has been responsible for supplying a lot of those players to the colleges.
Very cool. And are these a lot of kids coming straight out of high school or currently in high school? Kind of what's the age bracket?
Yeah, so our players range in age from 17 to 20. Some of them are finishing high school, but a lot of them, because they're so career-oriented, they finish high school a little early so that they can focus on hockey and develop their skills and get ready for the upper divisions.
Yeah, and I feel like college hockey is more bigger on the East Coast compared to maybe the West. Is that kind of the case or what you see?
Yeah, it is. But right now I see the West kind of developing a lot more schools. You know, you've got Colorado's got DU, and we've got Las Vegas, I heard, is trying to get NCAA, and so is Salt Lake City. So we're really working on getting the West a little more represented in the college levels. And so I see that increasing here more in the future.
Talk about how the hockey landscape has changed in Utah now that we have an NHL team.
It's like night and day. being a hockey fan here in Utah, of course, for the last 30 years without something like this, you know, we've relied on the Grizzlies for some amazing competitive hockey. And when the Utah Hockey Club came here, now Mammoth, of course, it just sparked something here in Utah. And what I'm excited for is that the community is going to get to find a love for the sport that we all have had here in Utah. And we've kind of been keeping it alive and alive. And finally, we have a hockey team in the NHL. And it's exciting. I'm elated when I heard the news, and I haven't stopped smiling since we got out. I've been to a bunch of games, and so I'm excited for the Mammoth this year, and it's going to be a great year for hockey in Utah in general.
Yeah, it's definitely felt welcome in the state. How long have you been with the Outliers organization?
This is my fifth year with the Outliers. I started out as a camera operator for the games because we do broadcast our games internationally. So, and then, you know, just kind of moved my way up and helped where I was needed. And so here I am now, my fifth year with the Outliers. I'm the game operations manager and the housing coordinator.
What's special to you about this unique league?
You know, first of all, the players. They're a different breed of, I would say, young adults. You can see their determination and how hard they work, and it shows through their personalities. It shows through who they are as players, and it's really amazing to be able to work with these type of athletes. Not to mention the fact that some of them could be in the future playing in the NHL, and it really is an honor to work with these kids and to watch them develop and grow and then move on as well.
Yeah. Well, we have this great hockey team down in Salt Lake City now, but we're not going to have this one that's even closer. What can residents expect in terms of getting tickets to come watch these games? I mean, what's kind of the vibe to get in the door and watch some hockey?
You know, tickets will go on sale here soon. You can visit us at utahoutliers.com for any ticket information and schedule information. And we're excited to make Park City, the Park City area, our permanent home. We're partnering up with the Black Rock Mountain Resort, and they built us a brand new shiny arena. And we're excited to play there. We're excited to play for the fans here in Park City. And it's going to be amazing. It's hard-hitting, fast. It's kind of reminiscent of college hockey a little bit.
Yeah.
Really fast, young hockey players, lots of energy, some fights. You'll see some fights, of course. But really just a great fan experience overall. That's one of the things we take a lot of pride in, is putting on a family-friendly show and making sure that everybody enjoys themselves while they're at the games.
Yeah, and new arena, from what I've seen, it can accommodate up to 2,000. This is a brand new modern arena. Can you talk about some of the cool aspects of it or features?
Yeah, it is. It's going to be state of the art. They'll have Jumbotron, so to speak, big nice TV screens for you to watch action on as well. And you know, look for an overall fun show. Kind of like if you've ever been to a professional basketball game or a hockey game, you know, you see all the different things that are happening in between periods and, you know, the kiss cam and a lot of other stuff. So you'll see all those things here at the arena. It's going to be an amazing fan experience, and we're excited to be able to give that to the community here.
Yeah, and can you talk a bit about just some of the coaching staff or any of the players that people can see this season?
Of course, yeah. We have I'm a little biased, but one of the most amazing coaches I've ever met, Paul Taylor, and he's assisted by Richard Bohan. Together, they've built some amazing teams over the years that I've enjoyed watching. We've won three Mountain Division championships in the NCDC, and that's no easy task, especially going back-to-back like that. There's a lot of great talent here just in the state of Utah, not to mention in the West. We've got Kevin McCloskey, who's an ex-professional hockey player that he just knows hockey more than anybody in the face of the planet, and so he's able to help us prepare for anything that might be thrown at the team logistically. And so we've got an amazing team and an amazing coaching staff. Some of the players, we've got a couple of returning players this year. We don't like to reveal a lot of our roster before the season starts, of course, for logistical reasons, but we do have some exciting. We've got Jesse Ivanovich coming back. We've also got John Carney coming back, both electric players, offensive scorers. So the fans are going to love watching both of them play this year.
NCDC is 30 teams in three separate divisions. I assume we're in the Mountain Division.
Yes.
What's kind of the season format and like postseason format?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we have a regular season just like any other professional hockey team. It's about, I believe, 44, 45 games total. We have home and away games, so we do travel quite a bit and play all the other teams in the Mountain Division. We do have a playoffs that start usually right around the end of March. Very exciting. It's a best of five series between all the teams in the West. And then the really amazing thing this year is the National Dineen Cup Championships are held in Idaho Falls, Idaho. So very close for us. In the past, we've had to travel back east for that. It was just not fun. So lots of days of travel. But this year, we're very excited to have that kind of in our own backyard. So we're excited to go up there and take a Dineen Cup and bring that back to Park City.
You also mentioned that you're the housing manager. We're well attuned to housing issues up here in Park City. Is that a problem, finding players housing, or just kind of what's that operation like?
You know, you would think it would be, but Already I've seen such a generosity and welcoming from the Park City area with families. And, you know, our program does not exist without our host families and the billeting program. It's really vital that for these players to have a home away from home. We really look for families that are wanting to not just give us a room in their home, but like include our players in their like family activities and family dinner and how was your day and things along those lines. And one of the things I found is when we find homes like that, it really makes our players more successful. It really does enhance our program, so to speak. And so one of the things that we're always looking for is anybody that can take, you know, players, families, you know, even with little kids. I mean, these young men are, they're well-mannered. I call them groomed. They do interviews. They've been, they know manners. They've been around the block and they've lived in many homes. And in all honesty, they don't get to this level without being really good individuals and having a good character. So we're always looking for homes here in the area.
Yeah, and for those listening that may have a space, what's the best way to reach out?
Yeah, you can go to UtahOutliers.com, and there is an actual on the very top a host family link. Or if you'd like to just email me, you can email me at bill@outliershockey.com. And I'm always, I'm pretty Johnny on the spot with the email. It's very important for our program to make sure we have a strong billet program. So it's a priority for us, and you'll get an answer right away. And, you know, I encourage everybody to reach out. Even if you know somebody that knows somebody, if you don't think you have, you know, an opportunity in your home, you might know someone. These boys do chores. They help around the house. They're big brothers.
They've got to be pretty strong, I assume.
they are. Big boys, over six foot, most of them. So, but they're a joy. I've billeted in the past, and I've hosted over 27 players. So it's an amazing experience, and you get a lot of great memories from it. So I really encourage everyone to at least give us a shot, and you won't stop doing it ever, I promise.
And NCDC, any rule changes compared to NHL or college?
You know, we try to stay aligned with the college rule book, especially with most of these players going to play college. The only difference you really see is in the fighting. The boys still get a five-minute major and a game misconduct, but in the NHL, they get to go back on the ice after 5 minutes, and then in our league, they don't. So they wave to the crowd, and they come back out a little bit later. So maybe even next game, depending on when it is. But for the most part, the rules are very in line with the NHL and with college hockey.
When's the first game?
You know, that's a good question. We'll have to watch this. We're still developing our schedule. Okay. Yeah, so I would say early fall is when our first games are. We typically start between the first and second week in October. You know, watch. There's going to be a lot of exciting stuff happening now that the arena's close to being finished. We're going to start pushing in the community with the Utah Outliers, and watch for schedule stuff. Watch for players being here in the Valley. All the players report on August 28th. So the team will be here in the Park City area here in the next few weeks.
Very exciting. Anything else you want to mention?
You know, just we're excited to be moving here. This is the first time, and this is the team's 10th year anniversary, and this is the very first time we will have a permanent home. We're excited to make Park City our home. We really are. And we know this area up here, and that's why we decided to make Park City our home. We know that these people and all the residents in this area, they need something like this. They really do. Something to kind of rally around and not have to drive all over to Salt Lake City for events and for stuff like that. And so we're really excited that we'll be able to embrace this community back like we know that they're going to embrace us.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate you coming in to share. We've been speaking with Bill McLeod with the Utah Outliers. Finally, what was the website again?
Yeah, it's UtahOutliers.com.
Pretty simple. Yeah. UtahOutliers.com. All right. Well, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks
and we'll
for having
have
me.
To have you in again soon to update us
anytime.
On everything. I'm now joined in studio by Summit Land Conservancy CEO Cheryl Fox. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing well. Getting to the Blue Sky Bash, that's your annual, I think, biggest fundraiser, correct?
That's our annual gala, yep.
Sold out, I'm told.
It is sold out. And in fact, we sold out about 3 weeks ago, and we thought, wow, that's probably cutting out people who really want to be there. So we figured out a way to add another table. That table has also sold out. But what I will tell people is there are always last minute cancellations. So if you have a little bit of flexibility and you feel like, wow, I would really like to go and I'm kind of bummed that we didn't get tickets this year, you can go on our website and we have a wait list there. You can call our office because there are always something, you know, something comes up at the last minute for people and they end up having an empty table or an empty seat. So, if people want to come, let us know.
Yeah. Is there a fundraising goal for that event?
We do have a pretty hefty fundraising goal after expenses are made. Yeah, it's about $500,000.
And that, is that, can you kind of talk about how big that event is just for the year-round operations of the
Conservancy? It's huge. You know, it's about a quarter of our overall operating expenses. I hate to use the word operating. Fixed costs is a better cost. You know, conservation easements don't write themselves. Land doesn't save itself. It requires a whole staff and an office and people to get it done. And so the Blue Sky Bash funds all of that kind of thing, but also sometimes actually direct land conservation. So, you know, when I was here in June, we talked about a project in the Camas Valley where the federal funding was just stuck and taking too long, and we just used our reserves to get it done. So that's what the Blue Sky Bash allows us to do.
Yeah, and speaking of the federal funding, there's obviously been a lot of slashing at that level. What have been the impacts to the Land Conservancy?
You know, I like to talk about the impacts to the families who are working with us to save their farms and ranches, because those are really the people who are counting on this funding to move forward with their operations, with other needs that they have as a family. And federal money is never easy to get, and it shouldn't be. It's taxpayer dollars. It should be, you know, well vetted. The changes at the federal government level at this point have slowed everything down, and it was already a pretty slow process. So it's just making those families wait a whole lot longer. Our funding, like all the rest of the funding, was put on hold. We were told it was good. Now we've been told it's not good. You know, that just creates some chaos, and it creates difficulty for families who were thinking they were going to be able to, you know, sell this easement and reinvest or send a kid to college or, you know, pay for somebody to move into assisted living. And, you know, people do have timelines. So we hope that things will get straightened out. We feel confident that the work that we do with farming and ranching families is something that aligns with the administration's priorities. But we're waiting still.
Yeah, and those cuts, are those at Department of Agriculture? Where are kind of those cuts that you're seeing the impacts?
They do come down to our programs are within the Farm Bill. And the Farm Bill is controversial because it also contains what they call the nutrition program, which are food stamps. Mm-hmm. And so those programs get cut. The conservation title, which is what we use to save farms and ranches, is not controversial. It has enjoyed bipartisan support. And funding for it was included in the Big Beautiful Bill. That has to, again, get massaged through the process, and hopefully we'll be able to see it. But then there's always the process of how do you apply for that money, who approves it,
yeah.
Do they have enough staff to go over the due diligence that they have to have? And, you know, we've done things to become certified, a certified entity, so that we can do our own due diligence and get things done a little more quickly with the goal of, you know, being able to serve these families. Because honestly, you know, there are people who are not interested into conservation who are talking to these families all the time saying, hey, you know, I can do your deal. I can, you know, we can just buy it from you. And then we lose it.
And a lot of the conservation funding, does that come directly from the federal government, or is it similar to like housing tax credits where the state receives a certain amount and then they distribute it?
It comes directly from the federal government. We work with the federal agency, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, Utah branch. We work closely with the state conservationist in Utah and the team there. They are hardworking, excellent, you know, federal employees, and with really great partnerships. And, you know, this on-again, off-again funding is really hard on them, too, because they also are doing work. They are also filling out forms. They are also, you know, pushing this through the systems. And so it's not just, you know, Summit Land Conservancy and our staff who is thwarted. They're caught in the same tangled web of red tape.
Well, moving on, the last Hops Hike is taking place on, that is tomorrow. What can you tell me about that event?
That's right. So all summer long, we take people out on conserved open spaces, and we walk and talk about wildflowers, and we look for the hops that grow wild. They were initially introduced into our ecosystem by people who were here mining. And so we go, we watch them grow, and then usually at the end of August we harvest them, but this year has been so dry, the harvest has been pushed off into September. And so the last hike is on Wednesday, August 6th. I think that also, you know, people don't have to pay for that, but they do have to register on our website because we, you know, can't have 1,000 people marching around on the trails. So visit our website, which is wesaveland.org, and go to the happenings tab. But anyway, it's great to go out, look at the hops, see how they're coming along, and then we will harvest them in September. And then our friends at Top of Maine Brewery, Brewpub, will create the ever-popular clothing optional wild hop ale.
Clothing optional?
Is that yes, clothing optional. Optional.
Gotcha.
Clothing optional.
And what trail will you all be going for that event tomorrow?
That is a good question, and you'll have to go to our website get the answer.
WeSaveLand.org, again, is the website. Nature bathing is going on in Oakley on August 21st. What does that entail?
That's right, and clothes are not optional on that one. nature bathing is a really interesting and fun activity, and people really enjoy it. So you go out onto some open space and kind of sit and think and listen. And we do charge a little bit for this because we have a person who comes in and actually leads us through the process and the meditation. I think we're not entirely sure which of our properties in Oakley we're going to visit for that one either. So again, people have to sign up on our website. But it's a really amazing experience. Different from, you know, I think a lot of times here in Park City, we're out on the trails and we need to get our heart rate up. We're in training mm-hmm. for whatever it is we're trying to do. Or we're just really familiar with the trail and sometimes don't see it, or we're listening to our podcasts. And this is an opportunity to really connect with the ground. And all kinds of studies show that this lowers blood pressure and increases overall sense of well-being. So I encourage people to join us for that.
Yes, and then a separate event on August 27th at Stevens Grove in Oakley. Kind of a fun name, Moonshine Adventure. What is that all about?
Yeah, we have a lot of fun names. clothing optional, Moonshine Adventure. This is where we go out in the full moon, or, you know, in the twilight. And again, because you get an opportunity to see things a little bit differently. And these are guided, and, you know, we encourage people to dress appropriately and bring lights if necessary. But again, it's just an opportunity to go out and see that part of the world in a different light. Sorry.
No moonshine served.
You have to bring your own.
almost out of time, but understand that you're working on an easement in Morgan County. What can you share
That's
about
right.
that?
It's large. It's just under 2,300 acres. We expect to be able to announce that has closed on Friday at the Blue Sky Bash. But this is an interesting project. It's not our first in Morgan County. We already have 5,000 acres under easement there. Actually, we did receive word that the federal government is funding another large project that's about 6,000 acres in Morgan County also. So we have a lot going on up there. But yeah, this will be the 11th conservation easement that we've done in the last 2.5 years since we launched the For the Future campaign. That's a lot of conservation.
Yeah. How does that compare to like a similar time period in the past?
It's, you know, when we launched the campaign, we did it because we knew we needed to save more land and save it faster. That's our part of saving the Great Salt Lake, is saving these farms and ranches on the Wasatch Back, which form the watershed for the Great Salt Lake. So we're trying to really double our impact.
Yes, and quickly, you will be out volunteering on the National Day of Service, which is September 13th, partnering with Summit County on Quarry Mountain. Can you just briefly talk about what that is? And people can sign up at wesaveland.org.
That's right. And it's the event organized by Serve Park City, and we wanted to participate with that this year. We'll be working on fixing a trail. There's a lot of rogue trails up there, and we wanted to clean that up and pull some weeds, and we're happy to partner with Summit County on that.
And that's at Quarry Mountain on September 13th. Again, website to find everything is wesaveland.org. We've been speaking with Summit Land Conservancy CEO Cheryl Fox. Thanks for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Parker.